Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, me. If you'll take your seats. I know those in the back of the room by name, and I'm perfectly capable of embarrassing you. Please sit down. I suppose that people still milling about out there, but I think if we set a good example, we might keep this thing roughly on time. I want to welcome you to the Philadelphia Society's consideration of the question, what we have learned from conservative governance. That is such a practical question that I can scarcely believe that I'm at the Philadelphia Society. I think it wasn't it Jim McClellan who said that the Philadelphia Society is a group of dedicated conservatives who individually can do nothing, but collectively can decide that nothing can be done. Oh, me. My name is Ken Cribb, and I'm doing double duty this afternoon. I was to have introduced the panel, and I will do that. But Michael Horowitz cannot be with us. Family illness. He's very, very sorry not to be with us. He was going to do the executive branch, so I'm going to do that as well. I'll introduce our panel members first so that we will have a continuity of presentations, and if you all will hold your questions till the end of the three presentations, we hope to have about half the time left by then for questions and discussion. We are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Lee Edwards. Lee is the senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's also president of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. He's the senior editor of the World and I magazine and also adjunct professor of politics at Catholic University. Lee is, if I read all the books that he has written, we would run out of time, and there are two more on the way, I understand. But let me mention the titles of two that are relevant for our consideration today. The Conservative Revolution, the Movement That Remade America, that was Free Press, and Ronald Reagan, a Political Biography. It's a pleasure to welcome Lee as one of our foremost and most gifted authors and thinkers. We also have with us Stephen Calabresi of Northwestern Law School. Professor Calabresi is the George C. Dix Professor of Constitutional Law at Northwestern. When Ed Meese asked me to help with his transition to the Justice Department after his confirmation, we put a brains trust together. I see Judge Ginsburg in the audience. He was part of that brains trust. Remember that retreat in Virginia, Doug, where we hashed out the problems of the world? And one of our informal advisors was Bob Bork. And he advised me that the one person that we must hire is Steve Calabresi. Now, Steve had been Judge Bork's law clerk and went on to clerk for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. But by this time, early in his career, he had already founded the Federalist Society, which I think is probably the most influential institutional influence on American law. He went on to become special assistant to Attorney General Meese. And when I went back to the White House after the Iran-Contra to head up domestic affairs, Ed Meese gave me his reluctant permission to take Steve with me. And I've never had a closer or more effective ally. I should mention that Steve is considered the country's foremost authority on the unitary nature of the executive power. And in his remarks, he will include the judiciary. Lee, in his remarks, will include the Congress, although they're not limited to those. They'll cover them, and I will cover executive branch in terms of conservative governance. Now, by conservative governance, we're talking about political governance, which, in terms of the great currents that move through our culture, is a surface phenomenon. The fact of certain macro improvements or accomplishments at the level of governance is in no way to deny some of the observations that have been made earlier this weekend about the deep problems that are obvious in both our high culture and in our popular culture. Those problems are for another day. Today I'm going to begin with an argument regarding the character of Reagan's governance, because when you're talking about conservative governance with regard to the American presidency, the only example in memory, at least plenary example, is Ronald Reagan. And It will be just that, an argument. I worked for him for 9 years, including the campaign, and I went to work for him because I agreed with his program for the country. And I'm glad to say that after 9 years of politics, I left admiring him more than when I went in. So those are my biases, and you should note them. Since I'm not an economist, I don't have to say on the one hand and on the other hand. Reagan used to joke that an economist is someone who sees something happen in practice and wonders if it could possibly occur in theory. Let me begin by recalling the world stage in 1980, so emphatically different from the world situation today. And I do this because I guess one question is, has there been conservative governance at the executive level? Was there such a thing? And as I say, at the level of politics, the answer is yes, and that's my argument. With the collapse of the communist East, the great intellectual conflict of this century was concluded by the brutal, fact-bound operation of history. And the intellectuals are the last to find out, as usual. We've seen the death of Soviet communism, the worldwide retreat of socialism, and the triumph of free institutions and free markets. There was certainly nothing inevitable about those gains. Indeed, as recently as the 1970s, there was a consensus among opinion elites that America's life force was waning in the face of waxing Soviet might. Our own president, Jimmy Carter, came to speak of his country's malaise. Well-known historians wrote heavy tomes about the American decline. And politicians believed that the relevant questions was how to withdraw from the world and how to redistribute the shrunken wealth of an American economy whose best days were behind it. You remember these consensus observations with our elites. Even worse, America seemed to be losing faith in the truth of our animating ideals. So far had we traveled from the founding impulse of our nation. And although our politicians prated about freedom as usual, they were not following through with policies which could sustain the quite deliberate choice of our founding fathers to elevate the spirit of liberty over the goal of equality of material condition. So in 1979, because he would not accept the dire verdict of American decline, Ronald Reagan once again roused himself to run for the presidency. As he put it, I quote here, "I felt our country had begun to abdicate its historical role as spiritual leader of the free world. The previous administration had accepted the notion that America was no longer the world power it once had been, that it had become powerless to shape world events." Well, how did we get from that world of 1980 to our present situation? And I think if there's one thing I want to leave from this argument, it's a sense that President Reagan instituted highly serious policies, and even more importantly, that those policies were thought through from first principles, from ideas. And I'm afraid that, at least in my own experience in politics, that such acts of mental concentration are all too rare. Most politicians don't know it, but ideas really do have consequences. But our daily focus is on the consequences, not the ideas. Who's up? Who's down? What are the politicians doing today? This is what the Washington Press Corps feeds the American public in a daily diet of 30-second news bites and gossip columns that poses analysis. But at the Philadelphia Society, we do talk about ideas. And it is precisely the world of ideas that Ronald Reagan inhabits. His mind engages at the level of the premise. And for that very reason, it's his reputation among journalists who don't have two premises to rub together. That's where he gets his reputation of being inattentive to the details of particular policies. He left the detail work to such second echelon types like me and Steve Calabresi. He pointed us in his direction. He supplied the premise, the agenda, the idea. And in the end, this is precisely a practical approach to governance, because ideas move the world. So what role did ideas play in Reagan's stewardship of the country? Well, as I have observed it over the years, the essence of Reagan's leadership has been to clearly articulate fundamental principles of governance and then always relate the policy question of the moment to one or more of those fundamental principles. What principles? The question that President Reagan always asks first is a question that most modern politicians have never asked themselves. What is the proper role of government under the American Constitution? That seems like a fairly abstract question for a practical politician to ask himself day to day when considering policy questions. To some ideologues, the question gets in the way of what's just, quote unquote. To some pragmatists, that question gets in the interferes with what works, with problem solving. But inconvenient as the question is, Reagan asks it because he knows that it is the consent of the governed that distinguishes our own experiment in liberty from the world's dictatorships that, against which we rebelled. Then in America, that consent is expressed in the Constitution as written, ratified, and amended by the people. Now, so Reagan believes that the Constitution secures the blessings of liberty by carefully limiting the power of the federal government over the lives of its citizens, but also by authorizing the federal government to protect its citizens from foreign adversaries. He knew that the one foundation he had to lay, a foundation on which all else rested, was to move toward restoring government to its proper role. And in service of that goal, he had a dual policy, two sides of the same coin. Reduce the intrusiveness of government in our daily lives, because that intrusiveness threatens liberty. Increase our ability to defend against foreign menace, because that menace threatens liberty. Now, I've just described three principles of governance that Ronald Reagan has articulated since the early 60s as the basis of his philosophy. Number one, fidelity to the consent of the governed as expressed in the commands of the written Constitution. Number two, limited government at home to protect personal freedom. Number three, strong defense to protect the collective freedoms of Americans from foreign menace. Now, that was to have been the introduction to the panel. Now I'll do the executive branch. What lessons can we draw from President Reagan's conduct of the executive branch of the government during his two terms? The first lesson I would draw is that it is possible to lead the country toward conservative reforms from the Oval Office. Now, you remember that very possibility was controversial in the late 70s because of the string of failed presidencies following the two terms of Dwight Eisenhower. The conventional wisdom in the opinion elites and the academic literature that the gigantic extent of the federal government and the very complexities of modern problems posed problems too various for one man to get his arms around as a president. You remember the literature on this. And then the failed presidency of Jimmy Carter seemed to validate that literature. It confirmed what the academics were telling us about the unwieldiness of the modern presidency. Well, from the Reagan experience, I think we learned that a successful modern president must clearly articulate the governing philosophy and then delegate the formulation and execution of policies that flow from that philosophy. In other words, the president has to operate as a true chief executive as opposed to a chief operating officer. And the premise, of course, is that he has a philosophy, and that's not been true of many of our modern leaders. With Reagan, it was true, and I that's why I spent 5 minutes laying it out. But the philosophy is not enough, and successful delegation depends on appointing to the principal offices of the nation, of the executive branch, people willing and able to prosecute policies true to the president's philosophy. I mean, if you're not going to micromanage, you've got to be able to trust your principal officers to be implementing policies that are true to the enunciated policy. And here, President Reagan's record is mixed, and I think we can learn from his successes and from his failures. He made brilliant appointments, like Ed Meese at Justice, Cap Weinberger at Defense, Bill Casey at the CIA, Dick Allen and Bill Clark at the National Security Council. He also accepted the recommendations of Mike Deaver and Stu Spencer to bring in Jim Baker, who in turn brought in Dick Darman and Dave Gergen. And I would add to that list of horribles, David Stockman, who was gifted but disloyal. predictably, President Reagan's greatest successes, because he was a delegator, were made where he made his best appointments. The transformation of the federal judiciary under Ed Meese, the defense buildup under Cap Weinberger, the restored intelligence capability under Bill Casey, the successful East-West strategy under Dick Allen and Bill Clark, the centralization of final approval of agency regulations under deregulators like Chris DeMuth, Jim Miller, and Doug Ginsburg. And to be fair, the whole administration pulled hard and pulled together on the Economic Recovery Act of 1981, which reduced the marginal rates, and the rest is history. We're still in the midst of the boom that has caused, along with other policies I want to get into. So, successful delegation of policy depends also not just on being able to clearly enunciate the basic and fundamental principles of governance, but also on appointing the right people. So it turns out that people are policy, as Ed Follner never tires of reminding us. But successful delegation also depends on holding presidential appointees accountable. The president must make 6,000 appointments throughout the executive branch and the related agencies. It is inevitable that mistakes will be made, just because of the sheer numbers, if nothing else. More than that, as we know, many people are attracted to politics because of ego and self-interest. And so self-serving Washington place seekers, who often call themselves pragmatists, were lined up to get into the Reagan administration, as in all administrations, and every future administration you can think of. And they're very good at it. When all you care about is place seeking, you tend to it. You learn how it's successfully done. And you hide your colorations and you get allies among people who are genuinely in the president's favor, seek their support, and people like that get in. Once in, their energies are devoting to making themselves look good rather than to fostering genuine achievement. Now, consequently, the one-loss record in their own shops becomes more important than fighting the good fight, which means if you're only interested in one loss, you really don't take on the hard fights. You don't try for the fight that you may, in fact, lose. There's a related syndrome at work. If what is important to you, as some minority of presidential appointees, it will always be the case, human nature being what it is, if what is important to you is commercial success after a stint in the administration, then one wants to avoid bad publicity and maybe even get a little good publicity. Well, who are the arbiters of publicity, good and bad? The left-wing establishment press that Stan Evans talked about last night. So the appointee sensitive to this is not going to push for the more difficult elements of the presidential agenda. It gets worse. The higher the official, the greater the access to sensitive information, information which is the lifeblood of the media. In return for leaks, the media is quite willing to exchange good publicity. So that a pragmatist who would probably never consider selling information that doesn't belong to him for cash can rarely resist the temptation of exchanging it for favorable press treatment. Now, once the media has the information, let me assure you, it is not used to advance conservative governance. So this is why accountability is so important. The president cannot change human nature. As Madison said in Federalist 51, what is government but the greatest of all reflections on human nature. What the president can do is fire appointees who give in to the baser instincts of human nature, since almost all of those 6,000 appointments serve at his pleasure. Now, as much as I love and admire President Reagan, and you know from my own remarks that is quite extensive, I have to admit that removing bad appointees from office was not his strong suit. He viscerally disliked getting involved in personnel terminations. I see Becky Norton Dunlop, who headed personnel for a while in the audience. An example was David Stockman. He was caught red-handed attacking the president's agenda in a prematurely released book. He thought the book would be released after he left office, but the galley circulated. And because of the president's aversion to firing anybody, Jim Baker was able to save his job. Well, to recap, successful conservative governance from the Oval Office depends upon the clear articulation of a governing philosophy, and conservative or no conservative, who has done that better than Ronald Reagan in any of our memory? It also depends on the delegation of policy formulation and execution to appointees who are willing, able, and accountable. Second lesson, the highest energies of a conservative administration should be devoted to structural arrangements that can shape whole classes of policies over long periods. Another way of thinking of this is of institutionalizing reform, working not only on changing individual government practices, but also changing the means by which government practices come about. In the interest of time, I'll treat only one, and then I'll give you a little throwaway on a second. But well, it's very important, the litigation in the United States. The court deals with cases impacting the public policies that the president is trying to implement. So at one level, you can work hard on the case at hand, and one should do that. You can also adopt litigation guidelines based, say, on the separation of powers that controls the Justice Department's position on scores of cases. There were times in the Meese Justice Department when one would forego a short-term Reagan policy goal because it offended some cross-cutting institutional consideration of a long-term, and therefore the stakes were much higher. An example would be the Graham-Rudman Budget Act. This was an act that Reagan favored. It was an attempt to get a handle on the deficits. But the only way to get through Congress was for Congress to vest some of the decision-making authority in the Congress itself, a move which offended the separation of powers. And the Reagan Justice Department successfully litigated that, attacking the law that the president favored, because of the more important question of fidelity to the Constitution and the important, and not just important, the crucially important doctrine of the separation of powers, because that's how we defend liberty in our country. This came up, of course, in Forrest's discussion of federalism. We don't depend on a cheap recitation of rights. The Soviet Constitution had that. We depend on enforcing our liberties by dividing power against itself. You can think of it as a horizontal a division of power with the separation of powers doctrine, and I'd say a vertical separation of power with the federalism principle. But that's how we do it. That was the founder's solution to protecting liberty. So if you're not working on those structural doctrines, you're not defending liberty. So it's much more important than 1 year's deficit in the Rudman Budget Act. Now, it had a happy ending, because we quietly negotiated with Senator Graham to put a severability clause in the law so that the rest of the law would stand when we hoped that the court would strike the offending section, and that's what happened. So the Graham-Rudman Act, in fact, became law. So we worked on individual cases, but we worked harder on litigation strategy, and we worked harder still on judicial selection. And in fact, I don't know of a single domestic issue that received more sustained attention over the 8 years at the highest levels of the administration. And think about the reason in terms of the institutional argument, or the structural argument I'm making, because if a subsequent administration can change litigation strategy, and does, but a subsequent administration cannot remove a federal judge with life tenure during his good behavior, Judge Ginsburg. but we work still hard on judicial selection, and I think the Joe Morris's generous but accurate references to Ed Meese, if it hadn't been for Ed, there'd have been a lot of patronage appointments, and we wouldn't have controlled all 12 circuits by the end of Reagan, 400 or so district judges, most of whom very faithful to what for shorthand could be called conservative principles, but really just obeying the law, treating the law as the Constitution as fundamental law and the statutes as binding. Now, I'll give you a little throwaway example, because it reflects poorly on me. And I had served with Mark Fowler in the legal side of the AD campaign, and when President took office, he appointed Mark head of the FCC. Well, I was sitting over there at the White House, working late, watching the networks trash the president every night. So I called Mark up and I said, "Mark, the networks are doing a number on President Reagan every night. What are you going to do about it?" And he says, "Nothing." says, but when I leave office, they're not going to be four channels, they're going to be 100 channels. Now, he was thinking structurally, right? He was thinking structural. And he was also doing his job and pursuing good policy, but you see the point, that my one night's peek at the networks and railing about it didn't do very much good, but creating 100 channels did do a lot of good, and it precisely diminished the power of the network. The third lesson I would posit is that conservative governance is made possible by staking out clear positions on the merits, not by splitting a difference and not by moving to the center. I won't give you an argument on it because my time is just about up. Suffice it to say that the most successful Republican president in memory was also the most conservative Republican president in memory, the one who resisted moving to the center. A fourth lesson is actually a limiting factor on conservative governance, and that is this. Power wielded beneficently in our constitutional system meets the same obstacles as power wielded destructively. As conservatives and constitutionalists, we should probably affirm those obstacles and applaud the limits they place even on well-intended conservative governance. Madison wrote that ambition must be made to counteract ambition, because the framers did not merely contemplate the abstract balancing of constitutional powers. They also envisaged that some officials would wield power from motives of ambition that had little to do with the public interest, but that such self-interest, if it could be made to oppose other people so motivated, would actually reinforce the separation of powers doctrine. It's easier to mobilize Britain with the supremacy of Parliament and party discipline. It is also easier to ruin Britain. So yes, the genuine genius of the American system, which divides power in order to preserve freedom, is a stumbling block for implementing the conservative agenda, but is also a safeguard for which we are grateful at those inevitable moments, as now, when our opponents achieve political power. Thank you.